Pseudopod, episode 149, July 3rd, 2009. This week's story, Mirror, by Michael James McFarland. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, this is your MP3 player or laptop, and this week's story comes to us from Michael James McFarland. Michael has been here before, and lives and writes in Washington State. He has a wife, two children, and a job in a grim brick building that used to be a tuberculosis sanitarium. Many of his co-workers claim to have seen things there. Your narrator this week is David Moore of the Game Master Show, and I'm going to let him tell you Michael's story. I promise you, having checked with both of them, it's true.
Mira, by Michael James McFarland. I won't go into the details surrounding my dismissal from a well-known East Coast brokerage firm, other than to say that I inadvertently let slip some information of a rather sensitive nature. And when it came down to drawing the line, the firm was more interested in maintaining their reputation than my livelihood. Of course they were, but I didn't exactly walk away empty-handed. They were all very civilized. There were no black marks on my resume. Hell, they even found me another job at a much smaller firm in Seattle. And that's where I met Mira, who this tale is really about. I'd like to think I met her by chance, but the way things turned out, it's hard to be certain of anything. It wasn't long after I moved into a small apartment house on Capitol Hill that she happened along. I'd made a habit of taking long walks after dinner each evening, becoming familiar with my new surroundings as I had when I'd first moved to Boston. On the night we met, I'd stumbled upon a crumbling old theater called the Mercury. It was a majestic, extravagant building, erected in 1926 according to its rain-washed cornerstone. Though it had seen better times, back in the days of raccoon coats and 23 Skidoo, before the Great Depression had turned the speakeasies and nightclubs into flop houses and soup kitchens. The large, backlit marquee advertised a double bill of vintage Hitchcock, Rear Window and Vertigo, neither of which I'd seen. I bought a ticket and walked inside. Halfway through the first feature, a young woman took a seat in the aisle directly behind me. I barely noticed her. I was so caught up in the lives and intrigues of the characters flickering across the screen. But when she touched my shoulder at the close of the first film, I remembered her. The way she'd come in, her heels tapping briskly along the sticky concrete, hurrying to get a seat in the near-empty theater. I turned and got my first good look at her. The house lights were coming up along the aisles, allowing those who'd come earlier to take their exit, and the rest of us to go catch a smoke or buy another bag of popcorn while the second feature was ready. Her hair was long and dark, raven black against the pale luster of her skin, and she wore it swept up behind her neck in an ornate silver clasp. Her eyes were green, so brilliantly so that they seemed to shine with their own faint illumination, though this was no doubt a reflection of the colored spotlights that appeared on the screen. I recall thinking then and there that hers was a beauty that men would kill to possess, even in that first hasty glance. "Pardon me, would you mind if I sat with you?" she inquired in a voice which, despite its refined manner, held a certain huskiness to it, like Betty Davis or Garbo, women who devoured their men like Black Widow spiders. Yet she was also embarrassed by her own forwardness and went on to explain. "There's a man in the back aisle. He's been following me. I thought I'd given him the shake when I came in, but he's there." "No, of course not," I smiled, glancing toward the back wall. "In fact, I'd like the company." I rose, and as she made her way around the end of the aisle, I took a longer study of the last row. It was occupied by two silhouettes, both vaguely male and seated well apart from one another. I jumped as the door to the lobby swung open and a bright shaft of light fell upon the shape seated closest to the aisle. He looked for all the world like a dead man, propped up in his seat, head lolling back, and staring at the delicately plastered cornice along the wall. Then she was coming, making her way across my row, a gray sweater folded over one arm and a slim black purse clutched in her hand. She was smiling. I shot a final glance back as she took the seat next to mine. The door had closed and he was a gloomy brown silhouette once again. "Creepy looking, isn't he?" She shuddered, her eyes on the spotlit screen, a shadow of the smile still lingering about her mouth. She turned and looked at me, a pleased expression settling over her finely sculpted features. Men kill to possess. My name's Mira, she said, offering me her hand. It was alabaster white, warm to the touch. But then everything about Mira was a contradiction. At the close of the second feature, I asked if she would join me for a cup of coffee, to which she agreed after a moment's wistful hesitation. I told her I'd only recently moved from Boston and suggested she pick the cafe. As we rose, preparing to leave, I remember the man in the last row and scanned the back of the theater as I helped Mira into her sweater. Others were leaving, shuffling stiffly along the aisles, and it was hard to get a good look. But he was still there, looking right back at me. His eyes had a suggestion of urgency about them, and looking back, with the clarity of hindsight, I think there was a warning there, too. Then Mira had my arm and was pulling me toward the far exit. We saw each other quite regularly after that first chance meeting. I devoted all my free time to her, and the shortening days of autumn passed quite pleasurably in the long exploratory walks along the piers and storefronts, and ended in talk over a warm fire and a nightcap in the front room of my cozy apartment. Always my apartment. Mira had a sad, almost tragic manner about her, which at once seduced and captivated me. I don't know how better to describe it, other than she seemed terribly misplaced. Lost and alone in a city of thousands. A beautiful refugee from a strange and haunted land. Day by day, hour by hour, she wove a net about me, and I had the audacity to think of her as mine. Undeniably mine. My romantic advances towards her fell shamefully short, clumsy efforts that they were. But Mira didn't seem to mind. She was too strong to be pinned down so easily, too wild, and brushed them aside as if the words had never even touched her. Indeed, the whole subject of sex seemed almost vulgar and unapproachable with her. She was a sad princess whose raw beauty merited a prince, and she was content to wait and to pine for him, whenever he might appear. Quite obviously, I was not that man. Alone at night after she'd leave, I'd lie awake torturing myself with thoughts of her beside me, her dark hair spread against the pillow, her soft skin against mine, and she would whisper in my ear how much she loved me, how she wanted me from the first. But these were maddening flights of fancy, without substance, without a chance. Come the cold light of morning, I would be content to take the moments she offered, like a favorite lapdog. Fearful that if I pressed the point, she might disappear from my life just as suddenly as she'd come. We had been seeing each other steadily for 3 months, three of the most draining months I can remember, when the thing I'd come to dread most of all finally happened. Mira stopped calling. She stopped seeing me altogether. I wasn't really alarmed until the third day came and went, and still I hadn't heard from her. Our dates had never been what you might call routine, but we saw each other often, and it was rare for 2 days to pass without her calling or turning up on my doorstep. But 3 days, and never a word to me that she was going away. I paced my rooms, feeling helpless and frantic. I had no idea where to start looking for her. No idea at all. Somehow it just happened that I never learned where she lived, where she went in the rain-drenched night after she left my apartment. That sounds odd, I know, but with Mira, you took what you got and you were grateful. To make such personal inquiries, where she lived or what was her telephone number, seemed like a crass intrusion. A breach of etiquette, like asking the Queen of England where she kept her crown. God help me, I didn't even know her last name. Just Mira. Always Mira. So she disappeared, without warning or farewell, and I drifted through the dismal winter months like a ghost, through a seamless succession of days. My arms and legs propelled me aimlessly through the motions of everyday life, but there was no thought involved, no vitality. My performance at the office became tiresome and undistinguished, to say the least. my personal life, if you could call it that, evolved into a jumble of television faces which chattered blithely, emptily, as I sat in darkness each evening, drinking scotch and staring blearily back at them. It was hard to believe how deeply she had gotten into me, how, in 3 short months, essential she had become. The rain fell in daily showers, turning the landscape to a beaten and defeated shade of gray that reminded me of damp rot, of sorrow and loneliness and the grave. "Why did she go?" I asked myself endlessly. "She resented you. You were too possessive," a spiteful voice spoke up inside my head. "Why didn't she tell me?" "She didn't want you to follow. You wouldn't have let her go." "Yes, I would. I would have." "Killed to possess her." "Yes, I know." "No, damn it. Yes." It trailed away like a serpent. In January, I received a postcard from San Francisco, a bright summary photograph of the Golden Gate Bridge. It was taken from the south side of the bay, from the base of the bridge, and the titanic red columns thrusting up in the foreground looked large enough to support the sky. It reminded me of the scene in Vertigo, where Jimmy Stewart pulls Kim Novak out of the water. It reminded me of Mira. There were 6 words on the back. "I'm sorry. I had to leave." I'd just poured myself a drink, and the glass slipped from my hand. It shattered against the rough stone of the hearth. I put my hands over my face and sobbed. I moaned and lamented my sad, sorry state. I thought I'd hit bottom. The very bottom. I was wrong, though. I didn't foresee Mira's return, or where it was she'd really gone. It wasn't San Francisco. I can tell you that. I awoke with a start, sticky with perspiration and shivering. There was a panicked shout on my lips, but it died as the familiar shapes of my bedroom came out of the dark and huddled themselves around me. The sun had not yet risen, and the breeze that came through the open window was icy against my bare skin. I tried to remember when I'd opened it and found I couldn't. Not so unusual these days. Most nights I was too drunk to recall going to bed. That was going to change, I swore to myself, wincing as a slash of red flared and throbbed along the left side of my brain. I knew from the dry, raging quality of the hangover that I'd only been asleep for 3 or 4 hours. It was like waking up from surgery after a good whiff of anesthesia. Not very pleasant. I sat up slowly and waited for the room to decide where it wanted to settle. Despite the open window, I thought I detected an odor to the room that didn't go along with the usual bed sweats and alcohol. It was dark and musty, with a saltiness that was uncomfortably close to semen. Mira. Had I been dreaming of her again? Why couldn't I untangle myself from those memories? Groaning, I rose to close the window and tripped over something in the dark. A shoe, tangled up in the ball of my shirt. Well, at least I'd had the presence of mind to take them off before tumbling into bed. I couldn't always count on that. I crashed thickly against the windowsill and reached for the latch, peered outside. I froze. On the street, 2 stories down, a woman stepped out of the building's shadowed atrium and into the cold, white glow of the streetlight. I saw skin that was luminously pale under long, dark hair. She walked slowly along the sidewalk. "Mira," I whispered hoarsely against the breeze. She paused beneath the lamp and turned, her face tilted up toward me and smiling. Unmistakable. "Mira!" I screamed, and she began to laugh. I'll never forget that sound. As long as she haunts my dreams, I'll never forget. It bounced and echoed along the street like the titter of some mad bird. Then she turned to go. "No!" I ran to catch her, but my legs weren't up to the task. I tripped over the same shoe in the dark and somehow lost my way to the door. Through the window, her laughter followed her footsteps down the rain-soaked street. Doubts set in like thorns the next morning. Had it really been her I'd seen from my window in the early morning hours? Or just someone who reminded me of her? The more I thought about it, the less I was convinced. In fact, the whole episode began to take on the fleeting, insubstantial quality of a dream, something you try desperately to wring some sense out of until you realize there's nothing there. There's no core to it, and all the pieces in your hands are all ghostly and paper thin, scraps and images. I allowed that I probably did wake up in the middle of the night, somewhere in that ragged area between drunk and hangover, and got up to close the window. Probably I had been dreaming about her as well. The woman on the street was just similar enough and distant enough to spark the inevitable connection. She'd laughed when she'd seen me leaning out of the second floor window, drunk and in my underwear. A sorry, sorry spectacle. I don't blame her for laughing. But it wasn't Mira. I'm fairly certain of that. Mira's gone, I told myself over and over throughout the day. It was time for me to put her away for good and get on with my life. And to prove my resolve, I poured the remains of my liquor supply down the kitchen sink. I went for a long walk along the waterfront and stared down at the cold gray waters of Puget Sound as they lapped hungrily at the barnacle-encrusted piers. I looked at the faces of those passing by, listened to the sound of their voices, and did my best to exorcise Mira from my thoughts. I ate a proper supper and went to bed early and sober that night, intent on a long and uninterrupted sleep. Wrong. Wrong. I awoke to moonlight, cold and winter white, and reached for my bedside clock, puzzled over the odd angles of its hands before coming to the slow realization that it was still the middle of the night. I moaned and set it back on the nightstand, annoyed, then spent the next 5 minutes searching for a way back to sleep. I almost had it within my grasp when the creak of a door hinge sent it fluttering away for good, like a flock of sparrows, never to return. The door creaked shut, and I heard the sound of footsteps moving about the front rooms of my apartment. Not furtive and stealthy as if a burglar had come to rob me in the middle of the night, but soft and considerate, as if someone familiar as a wife had come back late from an errand and, mindful that I would be sleeping, did not wish to wake me. But I had no wife. A light came on and shone as a bright yellow line at the base of my bedroom door, a warm contrast to the silvery moon glow. A slow chill crawled along the curve of my back and burrowed into a primitive knot at the base of my neck, causing all the tiny hairs there to stand on end. A palpable coldness settled across the room as the padded footsteps finally made their way back to the bedroom. A shadow appeared at the base of the door, and my heart began to bang in panic against my ribcage. The floor tilted and yawed in a brief, untethered freefall, and then stiffened again as the knob turned. The door opened, and she was there, naked against the light. "Mira?" I whispered uncertainly, unable to trust my eyes, to believe that she'd come back. "Is it you?" I asked, no longer sure. "Is it really you?" She smiled. "Yes, of course it's me." The light circled around her body as she stepped into the room. She wore it draped over her shoulders like a wrap, a crown against her hair. "I couldn't leave you. Do you believe that?" I gazed up into her beautiful green eyes, mesmerized. I searched for you for days, weeks. Where did you go?" The question hung unanswered between us, a plume of warm breath in the air. Stillborn. "Do you still want me?" she wondered, the question just short of ridiculous. Her body shifted and the light lapped at her breast. The nipple, fat and aroused, stood out in clear relief. I was living inside a dream, dying there, well satisfied with the feel of the hook inside my mouth. Did I still want her? "Yes," I said. "Of course I did. I would have killed for her." She smiled, pleased with my reply. Standing over me, she turned slightly on her heel, and the darkness took back her breast. Her face fell behind a veil of shadows, and I could smell the bewitching scent of her musk. It was urgent and raw, an almost animal smell. I felt myself stiffen, turn to steel. "Good," she cooed, "because I want you to." She walked back to the door and pushed it shut. The harsh black shadows disappeared and the moonlight took back the room. It collected gloomily in the corners and gleamed coolly against her skin as she crossed, deliberate, to the window. Hungrily, I watched her body move. She was everything I'd imagined and more, much more. "I stood here and watched you sleep last night," she confessed, a bit shyly. "I thought you might wake up and catch me. I whispered my name in your ear. Do you remember?" I shook my head, a crease in my brow. She laughed. "You'd been drinking. I could smell it on your skin. So sad and sour, I had to open the window." "I'd wondered about that," I murmured. Mira did a slow pirouette in the moonlight. "Do you think I'm pretty?" "Yes," I replied. "God, yes." She came to me then, her arms out to be embraced. Her touch was cold, so cold it burned. "Sometimes I feel so lost and alone," she whispered down to me, her eyes glassy and impenetrable. "I feel like I'm frozen in ice." She climbed into bed and nuzzled against me. I hissed and shivered, but did not send her away. "Make me warm," she purred. Harsh morning light pried at the gummy cracks of my eyelids, and a solid certainty stole over me, even before I opened them, that Mira was gone. Flown back to wherever it was she spent her days. At first I felt a great relief at this, and then a profound sense of agony and loss. A weight out of all proportion, as if she had taken an essential part of me away with her. This time there was a note. I found it on the nightstand beside me, scratched out in her loose, careless hand. A promise that she would return, by evening at the latest. A chill went through me, like silverfish burrowing beneath my skull. I looked out at the day. It was raining, the streets dissolving into a mist that was featureless and gray, and the room felt cold and damp against my skin. I felt terrible, weak and hungover despite the fact that I'd gone to bed sober. In the shower, I leaned heavily against the tile while hot water splashed and stung at my unresponsive skin. Nothing in the refrigerator appealed to me, and, forcing down a glass of orange juice on the presumption that a cold was coming on, I found myself drawn to the armchair in front of the television. There was a throw blanket draped over its back, which I couldn't recall pulling down off the closet shelf, but I wrapped it around myself gratefully. Faces pressed themselves flat against the television's glassy eye, mouths flapping, pouring out their urgent, impassioned messages as I dozed and waited for the daylight to bleed itself from the sky, for her to return. An uneasy sleep found me, and I dreamt of Mira, stretched out on a slab in the morgue, while the attendant lay behind a desk in his cramped office, gray with frostbite, a long black strand caught in the gold circle of his wedding band. I awoke with a grunt, stiff and disoriented. The room was grainy and brown with the encroaching shadows of twilight. The television, a dead, silent eye staring back at me. I heard a sound like a whisper of wings behind me, and Mira was there. Her hair pulled back from her face and fastened with a clasp down the back of her neck. Her eyes were very green, very wide as they gazed down at me. "You've been talking in your sleep," she said, her tone unreadable. Startled, I began to sputter out an awkward apology, and she pressed a cool, pointed fingertip to my lips. Her gown was long and gauzy, like bandages or a loose-fitting shroud, and it trailed languidly about her as she walked around the overstuffed arm of the chair to face me. Her expression was intent, a solemn shadow against the breezy curtain. She'd opened the window again, and the room had grown cold in the coming night. "Would you really die for me?" she asked, tears on her lashes. I reached up for her and smiled. Let's go out for a walk, she said, rising from the bed. My head is full of cobwebs and I need to stretch. What now? I groaned and rolled my head against the pillow. The clock on the table read just after 9. It's dark outside. Besides, I'm comfortable here. With you. Ah, but I won't be here for long, she smiled, pulling her long white gown over the tangled bed covers. She searched its wrinkles and seams for the opening and pulled it on over her head, letting it fall around her. You'll have to decide what you want, love, me or your bed. I want you in my bed, I said emphatically, watching her move in the dark. She prowled back and forth over the bare floorboards as restless as a cat. At the window, she paused and looked down at the street, her head tracking something as it moved along the sidewalk. She turned impatiently, the waspish shape of her body a hazy shadow wrapped in the moon glow. Come on, lazy, get dressed. With a sigh, I threw back the covers. The streets were polished and black from the day's long showers, and gutters puddled with mirrors that threw back the glimmer of street lamps and the pure white light of the moon. The pavement itself smelled like a rusted stone. A chunk of heavy ore brought up from the bottom of a mountain stream, broken and yellowed by the crushing rapids. I'd brought an umbrella, but the clouds were parting, stretching to thin tatters that allowed even a distant prick of starlight to shine through, which was a rare enough sight in January. Mira seemed not to notice, or not to care. She walked with her eyes fixed upon a floating point in the sidewalk, moving at a hurried pace through a jumble of streets that led to no place in particular. I lagged, half a step behind, content to let her lead, and eventually we wound about to the place where we'd met, the old theater, the Mercury, its oversized marquee ablaze in shades of red and blue and white. Mira stopped and looked up at the stock black letters as if she'd just stepped out of a dream. The bill was a double dose of Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, Key Largo and The Big Sleep, two scratchy old films I'd seen once or twice on the Late Late Show. I met someone here once, Mira said softly, her eyes misty and out of focus. Then she smiled. It was a slight, wistful smile, haunting and bittersweet. A man who was very patient and kind to me, and I repaid his kindness with treachery and lies. Tears began to fall down her cheeks. Mira, I said, reaching out for her while passers-by parted around us. They all glanced at Mira. I might have been a ghost in her presence. A drab shade of brown or gray standing beside her. She stiffened and the embrace became awkward. It's so cold out here. She shivered, hiding her face from the passing eyes. She glanced at the ticket booth. Take me inside. We'll sit for a while and get warm. Of course, I replied. We sat in the back, close enough to the projectionist booth to hear the clack-clack of the reels and the hum of the fan as the film slowly unwound. I watched the images with no real attention to the plot. A man wandering along an endless series of stops and errands, bookstore, nightclub, mansion, speaking slick, meaningless words to pretty girls who were now old and gray or dead. He carried a gun and drove about in a large black car. Halfway through the second reel, the film broke and we were left staring at a blank white screen, while heads turned and booed the projectionist. I looked at Mira. Would you like some popcorn? Something to drink? Mira shook her head. Mira? I turned her face to mine. There were tears on her lashes. What is it? Why are you so sad? She opened her purse for a tissue, busied herself for a time in drying her eyes. Mira, what? Have you ever wondered what hell must be like? She suddenly blurted. Then without pause answered, I don't think it's at all what we were taught in Sunday school. That nonsense about a lake of fire and demons with pitchforks capering about. She touched a trembling hand to her temple, glanced sideways at me, then quickly away, back at the blank window of the screen. I think hell is a place where you live forever, and every day you wake up cold and alone, repeating the same damn mistakes and never learning from them. She laughed softly to herself. It was an empty sound, bleak as death gnawing at one's ear. "What do you think?" she sniffed and looked at me. I don't know, Mira," I stammered. "I've never given it much thought, I suppose." "No?" "Of course you haven't. It's morbid and thoroughly depressing." "Never mind, my darling," she said, leaning closer, slipping her arms inside my jacket, tilting her face up towards mine. "I'm in a blue mood tonight. It must be the rain. Don't pay any attention to me." She snuggled closer still. "Or better yet, kiss me and make me forget about the cold and the rain." I bent and pressed my lips to hers. It was an effortless gesture, like falling, and as inevitable as dying. There was nothing I wanted more at that moment than to make her happy. "Oh, that's nice," she purred. And when she smiled, it was warm and genuine. She shifted away, and we watched the movie for a while. The house lights went up with the credits, and Mira rose from her seat. I sat in mine as if peering up from the bottom of a deep, inescapable well. I watched her move down the aisle and take a seat behind a man in a dark flannel suit. I stared at the two of them, unable to move, my body becoming cold and hard, inflexible as a bone. She tapped the man on the shoulder, and as he turned, leaned forward to whisper at him. I saw him nod and smile as if he couldn't quite believe his luck. And then I saw the smile slip as he glanced back at me.
Writers spend their lives tilting at windmills. In fact, most people do, but for us, it's pretty much in the job description. Stage 1. Write down things that are awesome. Make hearts melt and strong men weep. Stage 2. Question marks. Stage 3. Profit. Or, at the very least, a lot of the time you should probably try and blow something really, really huge up and make people laugh. It seems to work for Michael Bay. That ideal, though, that flash of a white dress always a little ahead, always a little out of reach, is what drives us. It used to be called the questing beast. The ideal that, if ever found, would surely grant us our every wish, our every success. It's the brass ring, the golden ticket. It's what everyone from Charlie and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory to Hamlet spend their entire lives chasing, and they only do it because behind each and every one of them is an author driving them onwards, upwards towards that golden moment, that single, still point of calm. There is, of course, a problem. There always is. When you get there, if you do, it's done. Everything is over. There's nowhere else to go, nowhere higher to climb to, and nothing else to learn. It's that last one that terrifies me. The idea that somewhere out there is the red line beyond which there is no more knowledge, no more room to improve. So, you learn to enjoy the journey. You learn to be a better traveller, and if you can do that, then I think maybe the ideal gets a little closer anyway. You see a little more of the questing beast, your fingertips brush the brass ring. You hear her laugh a little clearer. You get better, and you accept that you'll never be perfect, and realise that actually, that makes you more interesting, more fun to be around. Or at least that's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated. The mighty engines of Pseudopod Towers, powered by the sweat and effort of our authors and the kind donations of you, the citizens of Pseudopia. Or maybe it's Pseudostat, I can never remember. Anyway, if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. It buys our hosting costs, pays our authors, and earns you our absolute and total gratitude. We're released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and we will see you next week for episode 150. Our closing music is by Hopeful Machines, a side project of Egolikeness. You can find out more about them at egolikeness.com. In the meantime, Pseudopod still hears the voices when it's dreaming.
Some places are far darker than deep space. Places where men go mad and lovers go missing. On July 9th, 2009, take a deep breath, turn off the lights, and dare to visit one of these places. And when the shadows smile, it will be the last thing you'll see. Crescent, the debut novel by Phil Rossi, coming to Amazon.com on July 9th, 2009. Be there to rush the charts and experience the terror. Scott Sigler, New York Times bestselling author of Contagious, calls Crescent the last stop at the intergalactic crossroads of gritty sci-fi and pucker-inducing horror. Blade Runner, as written by H.P. Lovecraft, a horrific, hard sci-fi express ride. Crescent, a novel by Phil Rossi. For more information and to download the free audiobook version and the Crescent original soundtrack, visit CrescentStation.net.